From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak. Now, this morning, we bring you a replay of two interviews held earlier this year. First, we speak with Yale University lecturer Wake Smith, who teaches a course on the topic of climate mitigation. He's also the author of the book Pandora's Toolbox, The Hopes and Hazards of Climate Intervention. In it, Smith provides insights into the hopes and hazards of some of the humanity's most controversial climate mitigation technologies. That's in the first part of the show. Then in the second half, we'll talk about mountain lions with Dr. David Stoner, research assistant professor for wildland resources at Utah State University. He'll outline the facts and myths about mountain lion behavior and, although extremely rare, why drought and warming temperatures have the potential to increase human-cougar encounters. Joining us is Professor Wake Smith. He's the author of Pandora's Toolbox, The Hopes and Hazards of Climate Intervention. And he joins us by phone. Are you there, Professor Smith?
I am here. I'm happy to be here.
All right. Appreciate you taking the time to join us this morning to talk about your book, Pandora's Toolbox, The Hopes and Hazards of Climate Intervention. And as Nell and I were going over your book, we're so appreciative because the book's table of contents follows perfectly the arc of the conversation we want to have with you about climate and mitigation, resiliency and adaptation, et cetera. So let's just, you know, let's get people up to speed, so to speak. I'm sure most people should be aware of what's going on. But what is the latest with respect to climate? How are we doing with respect to, say, concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, concentrations of other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere? What are the observations and trends there?
Well, the news isn't good, so you're gonna call me Mr. Sunshine by the end of this, jokingly. But we are continuing to not only emit, but we're continuing to increase our emissions. COVID knocked the stuffing out of the world economy and out of emissions as well, but we have already snapped back to the level of emissions that we were at pre-COVID, and the expectation is that we will break that record either this year or next year, not in a good way. So we are continuing to increase our emissions, and of course, what we need to find a way to do is to decrease our emissions, and not decrease them by a little bit, but decrease them all the way to net zero, which is just a much harder problem than I think most people appreciate.
Okay, so there's the numbers. What are the continuing now impacts and consequences associated with it?
Well, the consequences associated with climate change will be all manner of bad stuff weather-wise and climate-wise. But over the longer haul, the most problematical element of it is there may be large swaths of the earth that are currently heavily populated that will no longer support agriculture. And if that proves to be true, those people will need to migrate somewhere, some of them within their countries, but many of them across the globe searching for a place where they can survive. And so large-scale climate change is not merely weird weather and intense storms. It is reconfiguring where on the Earth's surface agriculture and therefore, again, most people can survive. So big potential problems if we go too far. In terms of what we've got to do about it, despite all of the other things that I discuss in Pandora's Toolbox, the primary thing we have to do is eat the same vegetables the IPCC is trying to tell us we've got to eat, by which I mean we've got to reduce our emissions, which means we've got to reduce the amount of energy that we derive from fossil fuels. We've got to use less energy. But for reasons we can discuss, both of those things are going to be really hard.
All right, well, let's discuss them. We got time, Wake. Let's because you lay out answers, changes that are on the surface pretty straightforward. Use less, consume less oil, coal, natural gas, etc. Why is that so hard?
Well, the first thing to note is that 80% of the world's primary energy supply derives from fossil fuels. Mm. That has been true all of my life, all of my father's life, and he's no longer with us. The point is, this statistic hasn't changed in a century, and it is still not changing. Now, you may say, well, Wake, you dummy, don't you know solar and wind power are growing by leaps and bounds? Mm-hmm. And that is true. But they're only growing, they're not yet eating into the share of the world's energy that derives from fossil fuels. The first problem is the pie is growing, the world's demand for energy is growing. And so as a proportion, solar and wind have to grow just to keep up with the growth of the pie, and they're doing that. Nuclear power is not growing in absolute terms. And so the next thing that solar and wind have to do before they start eating the share of fossil fuels is to backfill for the non-growth of nuclear, and they're doing that. But they're not yet growing fast enough to begin to capture share from coal and oil and gas. And it will be difficult for them to do that, in part because coal and oil and gas and nuclear are all forms of power that are referred to as dispatchable power. When you need some, you can turn those things on and get it. And the electricity system operates in such a way that when power is created, electricity is created, it's got to be consumed almost instantaneously. And when somebody turns on their light switch, a source of power has to be created that lights it instantaneously. The system doesn't store much power at all, like 3% of our electricity supply. So 90% of our electricity's got to be created when it's needed. Solar and wind aren't like that. It's only solar power when the sun is shining, and it reliably fails to shine for at least 12 hours a day because it's dark. Mm-hmm. Wind blows intermittently. And so while wind and solar can supply a third maybe of our power without big changes to the electrical grid, to go beyond a third, we need huge changes in how we use electricity and store electricity. And we just haven't put that infrastructure in place yet.
We also wanted to talk a little bit about sort of our future trajectory. So, you know, even if we were to reach, you know, net zero emissions tomorrow, and we know it's much further down the road than that, what does the process look like from there?
Well, so thank you for that question, because that's really, I think, the most surprising thing that people will find in Pandora's toolbox. The if we reach net zero, by which I mean we're no longer adding to the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. We've reduced most of our emissions, and those that are ongoing we're offsetting with negative emissions. But if we get to net zero quickly, then no problem. We've solved the climate problem. We've dodged the bullet. We haven't ruined the world. But if we get to net zero slowly, instead of by mid-century, if we get to net zero by the end of this century or into the next century, then there's a very significant risk that we will have ruined the climate before we got to net zero. And if we do that, then getting to net zero won't in and of itself solve the climate problem. I think one analogy that people sort of have in their heads, but is a wrong analogy, is analogizing greenhouse gas emissions to say air pollution. But Beijing hosted the Summer Olympics, what was it, 10 years ago, and they wanted the skies to be blue for the opening ceremony, so they shut off all the nearby factories a couple of weeks beforehand and limited driving within Beijing and Chongqing. Within a couple of weeks, the skies were clear, they had the blue skies they wanted, and I think people imagine that greenhouse gases would function in that same way. When we finally get to net zero, the gases exit the climate system and the climate's good. This doesn't work that way. CO2 in particular hangs around in the climate system for centuries to millennia. So however much CO2 we've pumped into the atmosphere by the time we finally stop emitting, that's how much CO2 the next many generations will have to live with for their entire lives. And so a different way of saying that is whatever the peak temperature is when we finally reach net zero, that's the temperature that the world is going to have to live with for centuries. And if high temperatures are what cause high climate damages, the world is going to have to live with those very high climate damages for centuries after net zero. And that's a facet of this problem that most people just are not yet focused on.
And if they are focused on, some of them will say, "That's what's the point then? Why bother? You know, so much that's baked into the cake. All right, now so much temperature change that's baked into the cake right now. Why should my efforts have any effect or impact?"
Well, because we can always make it yet warmer.
Right.
There's no point at which we're sort of done. We're not done until we reach net zero. And if we keep deferring reaching net zero, we will keep filling the climate system with more and more greenhouse gases and therefore warming the future. But you're onto the nub of a really problematical ethical question here. I'm in my mid-60s now. My excellent plan for how to deal with future climate damages is to be dead. And so if that's my plan, what incentive do I have to worry about this climate thing? Between now and whenever I die, it's probably not going to be that bad. The big problem is after I'm dead, why should I worry? And of course, as soon as you phrase it that way, that sounds ethically terrible.
Right. Sure.
But that's in fact the dilemma that we have. We know that we are creating huge problems for the unborn, but since those problems won't affect us, it's hard to get the world to undertake much sacrifice on behalf of the unborn.
Right, so it basically is saying, hey, it's warm today, it's going to be warmer tomorrow if we don't make changes to our behavior or consumption patterns. And so how warm do you want it? And the impacts, you say, there are areas of the globe where agricultural systems are impacted today. There's just going to be even more areas of the planet that will be rendered useless as agricultural centers, and not to mention sea level rise and coastal impacts and their uninhabitability too. So there's a whole series of knock-on effects that you say that not acting today presents to us tomorrow.
That's right, and yet it doesn't present them to us. It
right.
presents them to our successors on the planet. And it is just proving difficult to motivate people to sacrifice on behalf of other people whom they will never be and never meet. That's a difficult problem.
Well, let me reintroduce you. We're speaking with Professor Wake Smith. He's a lecturer at Yale University. He teaches a course on the topic of climate mitigation. And the syllabus of that course forms the basis of his new book, Pandora's Toolbox, The Hopes and Hazards of Climate Intervention. So, Wake, let's turn to acts of mitigation, because your book covers several different types of ways of mitigating. We've talked so far about the impacts and consequences and maybe some sense of adaptation that goes in. All right, what are we going to do to mitigate this problem, either using nature as a form of mitigation or man engineering our way out of this problem?
It's mostly going to be the latter thing. I'm a skeptic on the topic of nature-based climate solutions. It's not that they don't work. It's that they might solve 5 or 10% of the problem, and yet they have outsized size in people's imagination. People imagine, oh, we can just solve this problem by planting trees. That's just not even close to being right. Again, the problem is way bigger than that. And planting trees, which are themselves fragile stores of carbon, after all, the natural fate of forests is flame. Forest fires are a perfectly natural phenomenon. We can't plant a forest and imagine that it will permanently sequester its carbon. It will periodically give it back to the atmosphere. So that didn't get us very far. But the real problem is there's just not enough arable land on the planet that we could set aside for this purpose. This purpose produces no other economic benefit. We can't thereafter use this land as a field. We can't cut down the forest for lumber. That defeated our purpose. It's a fantasy to imagine that trees can be anything more than a peripheral part of the solution. But your question was about mitigation, which is to say reducing emissions. We mostly need to do that by accelerating the development of new technologies that can produce storable and usable energy without emitting carbon into the atmosphere. Someday that will happen. The world will move beyond the fossil fuel age. But again, if we simply let sort of the economy take its course in that regard, we will heat the planet far too much before we make that transition. We've got to accelerate that transition faster than the market will do by itself. And so that will take huge public investments and private investment in new technologies to transition the energy system to a new form of sectors that are very difficult to decarbonize. We're going to need to find ways to transition the economy in those regards as well. Unfortunately, most of the industrial economy that we've invented over the last couple of centuries, we're going to have to shift to very different modes of energy.
So shifting our attention a little bit to some of these, I guess, geoengineering and some of these ideas that seem almost like science fiction to us that are being sort of proposed or, I don't know, talked about as potential solutions to help manage our climate. And I'm trying to think, you know, Chris and I have been talking about these on and off for years, and we hear about things like cloud seeding and these wild sounding solutions. But you also talk about something called solar geoengineering or stratospheric aerosol injection. And again, this sounds wild. How does this
sounds
work?
Noble.
So yeah.
Aspirational.
So, can you give us a picture of what that is? And is it possible?
Yes, it's possible. But I'm going to divert, if I may, to something that I think comes before that time-wise. But for sure, we'll get back to this.
Okay.
We do need to reduce our emissions. But if we get to net zero slowly, the people standing in the net zero year will have a new set of problems. They can't mitigate any further. We're already at net zero, so we've shot that gun. That's a spent force. And yet, if the climate is still way too hot by that time for them, they're going to need to solve that problem. And the tools by which they might solve it are the tools in Pandora's toolbox. Now, I chose the title with care to signal in the very first word that the contents of Pandora's toolbox are not a set of panaceas. There are risks and problems in this. So this isn't meant to be the cost-free, risk-free solution to climate change. Rather, it's a solution to a different problem. It's not how do we get to net zero faster. The tools in Pandora's toolbox won't help with that problem very much. The problem they will help with is what happens if we get to net zero and we can't stand how hot it is then. Then we turn to Pandora's toolbox. And broadly, there's two kinds of things in Pandora's toolbox. One of them are ways to decrease in a man-made way and in a faster way the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. Because nature will take centuries to repair that problem. And if we don't want to wait for centuries, maybe millennia, then we've got to give nature a hand. And the way we're going to do that primarily is carbon dioxide removal. We're going to vacuum the Earth's atmosphere, which is exactly as big and problematical as it sounds.
Yeah.
But we're going to vacuum the Earth's atmosphere to remove the CO2 from it that we deployed into it. We think we have the technology by which to do that, but it would cost trillions of dollars every year for a few centuries, trillions of dollars a year, you know, $5 trillion-ish. This is the size of the entire oil and coal and natural gas industry. That we would need an industry of that size to suck the carbon back down out of the atmosphere. But if we were willing to spend that kind of money on it, we could do it. And we would put that carbon, again, not in trees or in soil, which are fragile banks of carbon, and they would release their carbon back to the atmosphere after a while. We would pump it back down underground, where ironically we got the oil from in the first place when we drilled for the oil. But that reverse oil drilling process, sucking the carbon from the atmosphere and putting it in the ground, is what will be needed to reduce the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and thereby cool the Earth, begin to actually solve the climate problem. But there's a further problem, which is that if in that net zero year, the world commits itself to spend trillions of dollars a year thereafter for a couple of centuries to repair the climate problem, the people standing in that net zero year will say, well, great, that may be good for my grandchildren, but that's not going to do much for me. What am I going to do to cool the Earth right now in my lifetime so that we have a more habitable Earth, more similar to the Earth we have today? And the answer to that is stratospheric aerosol injections.
Okay.
All right. Well, we only have a few more minutes, but explain to us what that might look like. Who's going to do that? Who would be responsible for that? And how does that, what is the ongoing, as an engineer, what is the ongoing O&M, operation and maintenance of that, of such a geoengineering task look like?
Well, the cost is part of the good news story on this. There are bad news bits of this story. So once again, this is Pandora's toolbox. But the good news part of the stratospheric aerosol story is it's super cheap. It's tens of billions of dollars a year rather than a handful of trillions of dollars a year.
Okay.
So way, way cheaper. Mm-hmm. What we would do is mimic the impact that large volcanic eruptions occasionally have naturally. A volcano pops off, it blows a bunch of aerosol particles up into the lower stratosphere. Those quickly circulate around the entire Earth. They cool the Earth for a degree or so, for a year or so. And we know that the physics of this work, because again, we watch volcanoes do it periodically. We would likely use the very same material that volcanoes use, sulfur dioxide. And if we were to put in a man-made fashion sulfur dioxide high in the atmosphere continuously, this isn't a one-time intervention. It's something we would do for decades or a century. But if we did that, we could cool the Earth immediately and cheaply. And we're pretty confident it would work. What we have absolutely no confidence in is what else it might do that might be bad. So I'm not trying to sell this yet as a, again, as a panacea, but it's certainly a promising idea for a fire extinguisher we could use if the earth gets too hot. But again, the amount of outdoor research that's been done on this is almost zilch. So the immediate thing we need to do with respect to SAI is begin to research it and understand whether it is indeed a valid cure. It wouldn't cure the underlying problem, but it would address the worst symptom, which is heat, or whether there are other problems with it. The trickiest thing about this, though, is the first question you raised. Who would do this? We have no idea. We would hope that this would be done by a global, legitimate coalition of all the world's peoples under the supervision of the United Nations. But what I've just outlined is sort of a fairy tale. Could that sort of global cooperative effort be put together? It's sort of difficult as tank battles are breaking out in Eastern Europe to imagine a world that could cooperate to that degree, but that would be the hope.
All right, well, so we have to wrap up. So much more to discuss. Really appreciate you taking the time. Professor Wake Smith, author of Pandora's Toolbox, The Hopes and Hazards of Climate Intervention. Wake, where can people go if you have a website or so to learn more about your work?
They can go to wakesmith.earth. The book is available on from Cambridge University Press, but is easily accessible on Amazon. It tells a story that I'm afraid the world needs to better understand. So I hope that it will help people have a clearer vision as to what the future may look like.
Well, we hope to stay in touch with you and continue this conversation because it's not over. Thank you, Professor Smith, so much for taking the time to join us this morning on This Green Earth.
Very kind of you to have me.
Our second interview this week is another one we had earlier this year. It is with Dr. David Stoner. He's a research assistant professor for wildland resources at Utah State University. And he's here. He'll be talking about mountain lions. The population of mountain lions in Utah is healthy and robust. Interactions between humans and mountain lions are increasing, although rare. In fact, it's more likely that you'll be attacked by a tick in Summit County than a mountain lion. But Dr. David Stoner explains more, and here's that interview.
Joining us now for the second half of the show today is David Stoner. He is an assistant professor at Utah State University, and he's here to talk with us about mountain lions in Utah. David, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
It's my pleasure, Nell. Sorry I couldn't be there in person.
Yes, we're sorry we missed you today, but we'll aim for that next time.
Good, yes.
So our first question for you has to do kind of with population trends of mountain lions. It seems like in our communities up here in Summit and Wasatch counties that there's an increased awareness or an increased number of sort of sightings of mountain lions. And we're wondering if this has to do with population trends or if this just has to do with all of our Ring doorbell cameras and our camera traps and the technology that we're using now that enables us to see them more. Do you have any sense of that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And to back up just a little bit, there are really two big factors that drive mountain lion population dynamics. And the first and biggest one is fluctuations in their prey base, which influences the number of kittens that survive from one year to the next. And the next one would be hunting pressure that varies from one year to the next as a function of management objectives. So I think in this case, well, for one thing, it's hard to determine what the trends are. These animals are notoriously difficult to study and to monitor. But I think you're onto something there in that the more likely explanation for increased sightings is simply the increase in the amount of observations that we're making. I mean, if you think about the advent of combining cameras and video cameras with cell phones within the last 15 years, And then, as you point out, camera traps in the woods for recreational purposes, and then our own home security systems. What's showing up is that we're seeing these animals are perhaps in our midst more frequently than we had assumed. And I think it's more a matter of intensive observations than it is increases in population abundance. I mean, these animals are notoriously difficult to observe, and they're secretive. They're active at night, not so much during the day. They don't really draw attention to themselves. They blend in. So they are hard to see. And therefore, until all of these cameras and photographic technology started, we inundated the wilderness with these things. They were there all along. We just didn't know it.
And I think that this has brought about like more conversation about people's perspectives on living sort of amidst these creatures that we maybe didn't realize were passing through the backyard or, you know, through the neighborhood or on the favorite trail. And I think there's a little bit of a divide there. Some people appreciate the beauty and are excited to see this piece of our ecosystem, and other people are more concerned about safety. And so we're going to talk more about mountain lions sort of as a whole in the state, but I want to talk a little bit about safety in mountain lion habitat where we all live. You know, what is the actual risk? You know, what is the level of risk? Can you give us a sense of that?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's probably the most common question I'm asked.
I bet.
Human safety. So there's a lot there. Two things are at work. One is a bona fide concern for our well-being, and this is, I would call it a residual instinct from our ancient past, from times when human beings or Homo sapiens really were a prey item for a lot of things. So we, you know, our innate fear of the darkness and fear of predators it's real. There is a reason for it. It's not purely irrational. Even if in the modern day it is not the threat that it once was, perhaps 100,000 years ago. So that's what, you have that at work. Secondly, you have pretty extensive media coverage when there is an attack on a human being. And part of this is just because it is so rare, it captures the public's attention, and it taps into that primal fear. But the statistics on attacks are actually quite different. To give you a little background, and I won't go on at great length here, but this figure, the number of attacks on human beings, has been tracked very closely in North America, well, the United States and Canada at least, for the past 30 years. And in about the past 130 years, so a little over a century, there have been, I want to say, something on the order of 150 to 200 attacks on human beings in the United States and Canada. Of those, about a quarter of them were fatal. So what that amounts to is one to three, I'll call them encounters per year somewhere in North America, of which 25% of those are fatal, largely children. Spatially, there's another trend that's worth noting, that these attacks are not distributed evenly throughout mountain lion country. So if we look at how they're distributed, they fall disproportionately in several places, the first of which is British Columbia. The province of British Columbia accounts for about half of all mountain lion attacks that have been recorded.
Wow.
And of those, half of those, so a full 25%, occurred on Vancouver Island.
Wow.
It's unknown why. There's a lot of speculation that hypotheses about what might be happening there. Island populations often behave differently, but just recognize that they're clumped. And outside of British Columbia, you've had quite a few in California and in Colorado. Utah is notable in that no one has ever been killed by a mountain lion that we know of in the state of Utah. Mm-hmm. So it's not to say there haven't been close encounters or brushes or, you know, people being probably frightened beyond a comparison,
right.
But no fatalities.
How
so that?
I'm sorry, I'll just jump in. How many have you observed over your, decades of research? How many encounters have you had?
Well, many. I can't count them all because I've been doing it for a long time. And I started in California, and I've studied mountain lions pretty intensively in three or four parts of Utah. And now I'm working in Nevada as well. And in that time, we've captured and radio collared many, many mountain lions. But in terms, if I, recognizing that that's because of my role in the science of these animals. Mm-hmm. If I take that hat off and just put on, average citizen hiking in the woods, my tally is somewhere between zero and one.
Well, wow. Okay. that's
yeah, mine's at one.
Yours at one.
I spooked something in the brush a few years ago hiking up here in Logan Canyon, and I think it was a mountain lion, but I can't say for certain. So if you want to be generous, one. If you want to be cautious, zero.
Right. That you know of, of course, right?
You
may have had,
yes,
quote unquote, unconfirmed encounters because they are out there and they're observing us.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, these animals are the masters of disguise and of being very secretive. And that's, and in part, we think about one of the misconceptions that I encounter a lot is the idea that mountain lions are an endangered species, that they were once abundant and now they're rare. And that's not entirely false. They were extirpated from most of the eastern states and Canadian provinces. But in the West, they're quite widely distributed. And they are still here. And I would argue that one of the reasons they have survived in the face of the changes that have been brought about by human endeavor broadly is these reasons that they are secretive. They do not draw attention to themselves. They travel largely at night, and during the day when they're bedded, they tend to be in really remote areas, very reclusive. They do not draw attention to themselves the way some other animals do, such as bears and wolves that are very vocal and can be quite nonchalant around people. Hmm. So this is my own personal hypothesis, but one of the reasons that they're still here. And then I would add to that, and this is an important part, is they do very well in rough terrain. They are well adapted to rugged, remote environments, whereas a lot of other animals are not. That's their specialty, that they are cats. They are able to move through broken terrain quite easily. And so this has given them a natural advantage. It's staying alive and remaining part of our ecosystems.
So kind of circling back to the presence and the safety of mountain lions, it sounds like it's exceedingly rare for there to be attacks, and particularly here in Utah for whatever reason.
Yes.
Are there things that we do that can make us sort of more or less vulnerable or make us more or less safe?
Yeah, yes, that's a great question. So, yes, it's rare and unlikely, but nevertheless, it does happen, and it is a valid concern, especially for people living on the urban interface or that are using wildland environments regularly. And so a couple of things that come to mind. One is to keep in mind the natural circadian rhythms of the mountain lion. They are obligate carnivores. They survive by hunting other animals. They do not eat any vegetation. So their behavioral patterns are predicated on their major prey species, which in most of the West means mule deer and to a second to some degree elk. elk and mule deer are the major food resources. So the people I work with that are in environments like Park City or more rural areas, the first bit of advice is do not do things that will lure animals into your yard, especially mule deer. And they are naturally drawn to our yards because of irrigation, because of landscaping, ornamental gardens, vegetable gardens, bird feeders are all things that can attract deer. And to the extent that you are attracting deer, you may get more than you bargained for. So that's one thing people can do to reduce the odds of having a mountain lion show up in their property is do not encourage other wildlife to be there. From from the standpoint of activity, I have a friend here who is an avid jogger, and we were at a party one time, and she said, asked the same question, and I said, well, joggers are disproportionately represented in the victims of mountain lion attacks. And that is because they are often in an environment where deer may be active and they are behaving like a prey item, moving slowly through the woods. So for the joggers out there, I would say try to reduce the amount of time you spend jogging in riparian areas at dawn and dusk, because that's when the mountain lions become active, particularly dusk. So as the sun goes down, that's when the mountain lions become active. That's when they are actively hunting. They are looking for food. By dawn, they're settling down, but they are still active in those twilight hours. So to the extent that you can stay out of the habitat they're in, and I say riparian areas because they're just so productive, and there's always food for a predator in the riparian zone. They're just more productive. There's more things to eat there.
And by riparian, you're meaning like a stream habitat kind of?
Yes. Yeah. Pardon me. Stream side environments. Mm-hmm. So the space and the time, if you can avoid that, you will be in better shape. Children alone, that's, again, I hate to say this, it may upset some people, but small children are the number one victims of mountain lion attacks, and it's because they fit the profile much better. They're smaller, they're more manageable, they are less capable of fighting back. Mm-hmm. So children should not be unattended in these critical hours and areas, camping and things. I mean, just as an example of that, when my wife and I were much younger, we drove to California, and we stopped in central Nevada and camped on this creek in a very lonesome area, and it was sundown and there were deer everywhere. And our daughter was in that Frankenstein stage of she could walk, but it really stood out like a sore thumb because she was wobbling. And I tell you, we're setting up camp, and I had hairs on the back of my neck. We're standing up. I was suddenly, my inner caveman was quite aware of the circumstances. And
yeah.
So
you think like a mountain lion now. It's hardwired into you, I think.
It is. I guess so. And it was fine, of course, but there's just something there that gets triggered, that old instinct. So when you say, what can people do? These are actions they can take. Make their properties less attractive to wildlife. And then if it really is concerning to you, avoid those activities that might make you blend in with a prey item.
If you're just joining us, we are speaking with David Stoner. He is an assistant professor at Utah State University. And one last question, sort of as it relates to mountain lion risk or safety, pets, our dogs, our cats. I think that, there's some question, could they be drawing mountain lions to the yard as prey? And also on the flip side, if you are out jogging or hiking on the trail, does having a dog with you increase or decrease risk?
Right.
Yeah, Nell, I'm glad you brought that up. I got pontificating. That's excellent point.
I'll admit to our listeners, I've seen you present before and you present some fascinating information. So I want to make sure we get it all out there.
We got time.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I've enjoyed our discussions over the years. Yeah, pets. can be an attractant. So for, again, going back to making your yard, I don't want to say wildlife unfriendly. That is certainly not the message I want to convey, but don't attract things in. And again, this may be unsettling for some listeners, but dogs and cats in a yard can be an attractant for predators. And indeed, the inverse of that is jogging with a dog or a dog with you on your camping trip. It can be a preventative measure. The old idea about dogs and cats don't get along, that translates quite readily into the wildlife world. For example, a study I'm running right now in southern Nevada, coyotes are the number three prey item on the list for the mountain lions. They eat a lot of coyotes. So a dog chained up at the house is bait, essentially. And this has been demonstrated over and over and over again. Many mountain lions in town, they're in killing pets, house cats, dogs, chicken coops, sheep, goats. Goats are a favorite. I mean, they love goats. So any of these domestic animals can be an attractant. But again, the inverse of that is a dog, well, a medium to large size dog, I should say. Little yapper dogs are not particularly protective in any environment. The big dogs can be a deterrent in a wildland setting.
All right, so two-part question here. In general, what's the estimate of the number of mountain lions within the state of Utah? And can I get a permit to go out and hunt mountain lions?
The answer to the second part is yes. Mountain lions are classified as a big game animal in Utah and most of the other Western states, not all, but most. So yes, that is something that one can do. The first part of your question, the number is that's where we start to get into it. Well, let's see, I've got to phrase this carefully on the radio. There's a lot of uncertainty in our population estimates. One of the things that the public demands of the state is an accounting for animals like this.
Yeah.
All the big game animals, really. And as I noted, mountain lions are difficult to count, so our estimates come with a lot of uncertainty. But they range from somewhere around 1,500 on the low end up to about 4,000 on the high end. Wow. So we tend to settle in at somewhere between 2,000 and 2,500, recognizing that the numbers fluctuate from year to year for the reasons I articulated earlier. But it really is hard to say.
Okay.
We can't go up in airplanes and count them.
Right.
We can't, they don't run around in big groups. We do have radio telemetry studies that give us an ability to measure how much space they use and how the densities vary in one environment to another. And we can extrapolate that to some degree, but that comes with a lot of risk because keep in mind the mountain lion tracks its food resources through the year. So again, deer and elk, the ungulates, they're migrating in response to snowpack in the high country and vegetation green up in the springtime and summer. And so the mountain lions are moving with their prey and the density can vary tremendously through the year. So let's say Park City is a snow basin. It holds a lot of snow. It's not going to hold a whole lot of big game animals, and therefore the numbers in the wintertime of mountain lions are going to be lower than they would be in the summer. So again, lots of error in our estimates. It is an ongoing effort to get better calculations of how many there are in develop techniques for tracking their abundance through time, but it's still an open area of research.
We have about 5 minutes left, and I want to ask about how do you do your research? How do you find these cats and, you know, collar them and track their whereabouts?
Yeah, it's a lot of work. It's tremendously time-consuming. So there are many ways, you know, many ways to skin a cat, many ways to catch a cat. The most effective way and the most common way in Utah and the states that have snowy winters is to use hound dogs. And this involves, so what we've done over the years, we hired professional trackers who have dogs that are trained to trail cats specifically. And what we would do during our field studies, so for the listening audience, I did my dissertation work out on the Kennecott Mine and the Camp Williams National Guard base right next door, and I've worked in some other parts of Utah as well. What we would do is go out on horseback with the dogs and just travel ridges, roads, trails, trying to find a track in the snow. And that in itself is extremely time consuming because you're looking for a needle in a haystack. I mean, these animals at their highest densities in Utah occur about 3 adults per 100 square kilometers. Mm. So there just aren't that many. Even when there's a lot of them, there aren't that many of them. Mm. So if you get lucky, you find a track, it's fresh enough that the dogs can work with it. You get the dogs lined out on it, make sure that they're following it in the right direction because they're not going by sight, they're going by smell. And dogs are not as fast as a mountain lion, but they've got big lungs, they can run all day long. And the mountain lion is built more for speed. They are the sprinters of the world,
right?
But they don't have the stamina. And so if those dogs can catch up to it, the mountain lion will take refuge in hopefully in a tree, sometimes in a cliff face, a pile of rocks, a cave. Out at Kennecott, they would run into culverts, which was problematic for a variety of reasons. But once they are at bay like that, then we can approach them pretty closely and use a tranquilizer gun to drug them and then lower them safely out of the tree and then take measurements, apply a radio collar. And then once you have a radio collar on them, and this is something that is the technology is we've really benefited from in the last 20 years, have GPS units in them. And so the collar itself will record the animal's location at some predetermined interval, let's say every 3 or 4 hours. And what's happening now is that those data points, those locations can be beamed to a satellite, which then can beam them down to your computer via email. And so you can actually put the points on a map that it's near real time. And that's how we find what they've been eating, where they've gone, how they've associated with other mountain lions, how close they get to human environments. Everything we want to know about them can be inferred from their movements and their travel routes.
It's incredible.
Yeah, 30 seconds. Is that information that's available to citizens to say go online and see where the mountain lions are?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, that's
less than 30
that's
seconds.
That's top secret.
That's
that kind of information could be misused. So it is. I mean, if you want, I can come down and give a talk and show you some things, but it's unfortunately not available for. The average citizen to observe.
That's interesting. Okay.
Well, we got to wrap up. Share with us the big picture trends. But yeah, as Chris said, we have to wrap up. David, I think we could have talked with you for another hour, but thank you for joining us for half the show today.
We'll have you back.
It's been my pleasure. And again, COVID hit our family last week, so I couldn't make it down in person, but I look forward to visiting with you again.
That's right. Next time. Well, that was David Stoner, research assistant professor at Utah State University, joining us this morning to talk all about mountain lions in Utah. Thanks so much.